Welcome back, everyone. I'll try and catch up quickly with a few announcements. I don't know where the bathrooms are, and if you needed it, I guess you found it. Somewhere out there, right? I'd like to acknowledge the steering committee. Five of us got together over the course of quite a long time. Actually, there was a sixth person who at the start, Jay Drydick, one of the professors at Carleton, who was my first contact on this, and then Stephen McGuire at Carleton, Mary Guzella, who's up here on stage, Stephen Hare, who asked one of our questions before, and Velo Mile. So there were five of us who did the planning for this conference, and thank you to these colleagues, and enjoy talking with them over lunchtime and so forth. This is basically a partnership among three organizations, University of St. Paul, and the public ethics area headed by Rajesh Shukla said, yes, we can use this venue and it'll help out in other sorts of ways to make it financially easier for us to put this on. The Center on Values and Ethics at Carleton University contributed financially as well as a heck of a lot of time from Stephen McGuire in the planning, so thank you for both of those. And this all started with an idea at the Ethics Practitioners Association of Canada, l'Association des Praticiens Éthiques du Canada, thinking, because we're an organization with a diversity of members, public servants and others, and veterans from previous times in the public service, that thinking, you know, stepping back and looking at this might be a good idea. So EPAC was very much involved in this, and you'll see on your program a reference to all three of these partners. As I mentioned before, there's a Wi-Fi connection if you have to use it. And I'd also like to thank our student helpers, Christian Potvorovsky, Emily York, Ben Kemp, and Maria Jose Avendano, who are helping out today. And I think that's all the administrative stuff I need to do. Otherwise, you'll ask me questions at certain points. And what we're going to head towards is, I'll say that we're trying to finish at 11:45. Actually, it's 10:50 that we want to finish this session and give a few minutes for some comments of, in effect, a tribute to John Tate before we have lunch. Lunch is 12:00 to 1:00. And then our two panels that looking at the situation now, panel two starting at 1:00, and then after the break in the afternoon, panel three looking to the future. And then we finish up at 4:45. So thanks a lot, and over to Mary Guzella to introduce Mary Dawson.
Thanks, Bob. Well, good morning, bonjour. I had the privilege of meeting John Tate in the 1980s at the Privy Council office, and thereafter had equal privilege of being a colleague at the Deputy Minister table from 1991 onwards. So I'm delighted that we're taking the time to really revisit the work that he and his colleagues did. On July 9th, 2007, the Conflict of Interest Act came into force, and on that very same day, Mary Dawson became the first Conflict of Interest and Ethics Commissioner of Canada under the Act, and she performed that role until her retirement in January of this year. La loi sur les conflits d'intérêts en vigueur depuis le 9 juillet 2007 a vu Mary Dawson la première commissaire au conflit d'intérêts et à l'éthique en vertu de cette loi, la fonction qu'elle a occupée jusqu'au début de cette année. I know that many of you are aware of Mary's distinguished legal career with the Department of Justice, culminating in her appointment as Associate Deputy Minister from 1988 to 2005. With degrees in both civil and common law, when she joined the department in 1970, Mary has drafted many important acts of Parliament, many of them in her early career, such as the Access to Information Act and the Privacy Act. Elle a aussi élaboré plusieurs autres projets de loi, tels que la loi sur la concurrence, la loi sur les langues officielles et la loi canadienne sur la santé. Mary led the public law sector for many years at the Department of Justice, providing legal advice to the government in all public law matters, including Aboriginal affairs. Mary is perhaps, though, best known in government circles for the extremely important role that she played in relation to constitutional matters, including the drafting of the Patriation Package, known as the Constitutional Act 1982, and all subsequent constitutional amendments and proposals, including, of course, the Meech Lake Accord and the Charlottetown Accord. Mary was made a Queen's Counsel in 1978 and named to the Order of Canada in 2007. As Conflict of Interest and Ethics Commissioner, Mary oversaw the conduct of senior public office holders. And we have seen and talked about how important leaders are earlier this morning. So she oversaw their conduct, including that of ministers and ministerial staff. Elle appliquait également le code des conflits d'intérêts des députés qui avait été élaboré par les députés eux-mêmes. So we're delighted to have Mary address us this morning and following her talk to take questions from the audience. A toi la parole, Mary.
Well, good morning. Thank you for your introduction, Mary. Before getting into the substance of what I am going to say today, I just wanted to share a few experiences I had working with John Tate. John really wasn't in Ottawa all that long. He came in 78 and he died in 98. So I had a career only lasted 20 years. And actually, as it turned out, I ended up having an awful lot to do with John Tate through his career. Right from 1978, that was when they decided to do the access and privacy legislation. And he was my instructing officer over at PCO. The other instructing officer for the Privacy Act, which was in the same big package, it was an omnibus bill, was Stephen Skelly, actually, from Justice. And the three of us used to meet together. Those acts were drafted together. But anyway, the Access Act, those acts took about 3 or 4 years to come to ultimate fruition. So there was a long association we had then. Then in 1980, I was named the Associate Chief Legislative Counsel, responsible for all the English legislation, and John was the head of the LNHP outfit over in PCO. So again, even on a management level, I worked with John a lot, right the way through, from 78 to 83. Then he went to Indian Affairs. And that was a little bit of a hiatus, except I happened to be working on a whole bunch of Aboriginal legislation then, the Aboriginal self-government, which never went anywhere. Indian, I think it was called Indian then, that was the word then, the Indian Self-Government Act, and also the Bill C-31, the one that sort of let the women back in the room and actually gave the vote back to Indian veterans and a number of things. He was the deputy over there at DIAND at the time. No, he was the assistant deputy, I guess. But we would have had our paths crossed. But then, lo and behold, in 1983, he came over to Justice as the assistant deputy minister of public law. And in drafting, I did an awful lot of those kind of acts that dealt with public law. So again, I had lots of dealings with John. Right through to 86. And then he went to Salgen, but then in 88 he came back as Deputy Minister of Justice, and at the same time I was made Associate Deputy Minister of Justice. So we worked closely together through our entire career. He was a very interesting guy. Very, very, very perfectionist. And he actually didn't suffer fools gladly. Occasionally you'd see him lose his temper, but you know, through that entire period he had a chronic illness, which is ultimately why he died so early. He was only in his 50s, so he made quite an impact on the government, and I kind of observed it personally. The other thing, the question that came up about where all this came from in the 90s, the Tate report. The thing that came to my mind was, you know, the 80s were quite a decade And I think John lived through a lot of the very important things that went on in the 80s, the charter to begin with, the access, all the opening up acts, the Official Languages Act it was a new Official Languages Act. Many pieces of legislation were enacted that reflected the charter, and many changes were necessary in that. So I would say he had a pretty good grounding in the 80s of sort of rights and good things and stuff that would lead to the ethics. So that's just a little add-on to that question that we had earlier. So I'm going to speak about my own office. It's no longer my own office. Pardon me, it's my former office. You'll pardon me if I talk about in the present occasionally. I'll talk about the organization of that office, and then I'll try and get on a little bit to some of the cases that we had to deal with. I'm hoping there'll be some questions and some discussion, too, on some of them. To get a start there, and of course what we're dealing with in the Conflict of Interest and Ethics Commissioner's Office is the different level. We've been talking so far today about the public service primarily, but these are the people that are not the public servants. These are the people that are either in the agencies or the ministers and parliamentarians and stuff. That office was one of about 8 or 10 oversight offices, still is. The earliest one of these oversight offices was the Auditor General or the Chief Electoral Officer, one or the other. They predated the other overseers by quite a bit. But then in the, again, in the 80s and into the 90s, there were access to information, privacy commissioners, lobbying, official languages, and all the rest of them. But my office was actually the only one that was actually part of Parliament. I reported through the Speaker of the House to Parliament, and we're actually listed amongst the parliamentary entities, the Senate, the House of Commons, the Library of Parliament, and the Conflict of Interest and Ethics Commissioner's Office. So we were a little bit different from the other overseers. The office oversees about 2,200 public officers, and that's to be distinguished from public servants. These are the governor and council appointees, the ministers, parliamentary secretaries, and ministerial staff. And across Canada, there's offices like that in every province, but ours had a sort of a different. Most of them did not deal with ministers or ministerial staff in particular, still don't. So each office is different. We weren't the first office. The office that developed in the provinces, as did the health rules and many other things in Canada. So we weren't a new idea, but there we were. There's a staff of about 50 people in the Conflict of Interest office, including the advisory and compliance. I see some members from the advisory and compliance here with us. That's the largest section, and they played a very important role because they do the advising and receive disclosures and that sort of thing. And there's a great emphasis in the office to giving advice with the little dictum, prevention rather than punishment. Then there's an outreach and communications section. Again, there's a heavy emphasis on doing advisories and on communication generally and outreach to the people that are under the Act. Then there's the investigation section, which does the work leading up to the investigation reports, and the legal section, and of course the corporate. So the main activities of the office are, as I mentioned, receiving declarations from reporting public office holders and members on their initial appointment, and then there's an annual requirement that they update those, fill out a form each year. Each of those give the advisors an opportunity to work with with those people if they see there's anything that looks like it's going to be problematic. And I should mention that every reporting public office holder has a officer from that advisory section assigned to them, so that they always know where they can go if they've got a question. We give individual advice. The office gives individual advice as requested, and we get lots and lots of requests for advice. There are public disclosures that are the office is responsible for on a website, and those public disclosures include summaries of the declarations. We don't disclose everything that we're told, but we disclose the stuff that has to be disclosed. Compliance measures that have been agreed to, reception of gifts, recusals. You have to declare gifts that are worth more than $200 if you receive them, regardless whether you can receive them. Of course, you don't declare them if you can't receive them, because you don't receive them. we put on guidelines and advisors. There's lots of them. There's an annual report for both the Act and the Code, incidentally. The members are under a whole separate code. Investigation reports are there on the website, administrative monetary penalties, and I think the five-year reviews of both the Act and the Members' Code are also on there, which have a total of about 98 recommendations, many of which have not been made acted upon. Interestingly, the Members' Code has had more changes made than the Act, and that's, I guess, partly because it's easier to amend a code than an Act. In that case, it just requires it to go through Parliament. It doesn't have the Senate, it doesn't have three readings or anything. It's just a resolution. Now, the Act is generally more stringent than the Code. It has two particular activities that are not under the Code at all. One is divestment of controlled goods, and controlled goods are things like shares, holdings, various kinds of holdings. The other one is the prohibition of certain outside activities, such as running a business or being hired somewhere or something. Now, those two I've actually on occasion said and have recommended some changes there, because both of those have overreach. They apply to some public office holders who could never use the opportunity that they might have or have put themselves into a conflict of interest. And so those are two overreaching ones, and there's no discretion. There's no conflict test or anything in there. But the Code doesn't have either of those requirements. The Act has very little in the way of general value statements. It doesn't have a preamble or a purpose clause or anything. The Code, on the other hand, does have all these things, so there's more flexibility in how you can interpret the Code to some extent. Under the Act, though, because of this, I generally stuck pretty closely to the wording, because I felt that this is the word that was enacted, it has to be interpreted as it says. But there were a few cases where I found that there had to be some common sense added to what some of the wording was, and so I didn't always stick 100% to the wording, but the thing that I always did, if I didn't stick to it, was mention it publicly and always refer to it in my annual reports. And nobody ever did anything about it, so I assume they were okay with it. Act has also, though, some room for broader reading of the rules. The gift rules, for example, are framed things that are reasonably seen to have been given to influence you. Well, that's an objective test to the observer, not a personal test. The word improperly is used in a couple of sections, and that gave me some scope in some of my investigations. You can't take improper advantage of your previous public office. Again, that word improper gave a certain amount of scope. Because actually that whole realm of ethics is so much fact-dependent and so much circumstance-dependent that sometimes it's hard to apply the rules strictly. I've interpreted, the other thing to mention is I've interpreted private interest fairly narrowly, taking my cue from the matters that are covered in the Act. The matters that have to be disclosed, for example, are all financial and business. So I don't get into personal issues, or didn't. when interpreting a private interest. I thought that was the correct interpretation. And the other big exception is political interests. And that's colored by the fact that, the ministers and the members are political entities, and there's certain requirements of helping your constituents, which are necessary. And in fact, in the code, there's an express exception an express capacity to carry out your normal constituency dealings. So it gets a little bit complex. Now, I'll move on to the investigations. I'll give you just a general overview of that. They're called examinations under the Act and inquiries under the Code, just to confuse people. I use the generic term investigations with some caution because the media always, you have to be very careful. You have to say looking into if you're not actually instituting an examination. So it was always a problem in explaining what you were doing, because quite often you say, oh, I'm looking into this, and the next thing you know, the media has said, okay, this examination is taking place. By the way, the media was a great, I put a lot of time for the media. They were a great assistance in an ethics regime. Of course, they made public the things you wanted made public. It was probably the best public communications tool we had. So the investigations are initiated on a complaint of a member or a senator. That sort of harks back to the history of that act. It originally was intended to cover senators as well as members, but the senators wouldn't pass it that way. And so I think there was a few things left over in the act, which probably would have been consequentially deleted if they'd done it. But they weren't. So anyway, a senator can make a complaint, but a member of the public can't. However, the commissioner has the power to self-initiate a complaint, and our practice was always any letter or call that we got from the public, I would always look into. We would see see whether there was something there, and some of them indeed were the source of some of the self-initiated complaints. And we always got back to the person that brought the request and said, you've asked us to do this. It's outside our jurisdiction, or we've looked into it and it's not founded, or we've gone ahead and investigated it. And the other place, of course, was media reports, where we got a lot of our information for the self-initiated investigations. There have been suggestions that the public should be allowed to initiate complaints, and I think that is going too far, as a matter of fact, because a lot of nutcases send requests in too, so you have to kind of watch that. there's a lot of statutory delays between the steps of the process of carrying out an investigation, and that explains why it takes a while to get a report out. And particularly if you've got a person that you're investigating that's not cooperating, because they take full advantage of all possible delays. But of course, the due process is essential in this kind of a scheme. So there's no penalties either, imprisonment or hangings or penalties of any sort. It's just the public disclosure that I think that is the most important thing, and I think actually it would be inappropriate to have big penalties. The Americans, for example, in some states in particular, have really high penalties, and that's not one of the things I advocated. There's a judicial review of the decisions of the commissioner, but not on the substance of the decision. The review is on jurisdiction or due process issues. So that's kind of an overview of how the investigations work. I think that the best way to discuss the prohibitions in the Act and the Members' Code is through the public investigation reports, because I can discuss those. I can't discuss stuff that was just advice we gave or communications between public office holders and the office. But secondly, it's where the rubber hits the road. And actually, it's all very well to talk the philosophical principles, but it's the individual cases that really bring the issues to light. And they're always different. There's always different aspects that you have to take into account. So I'll start off with the fundamental, what I consider the fundamental rules of the Act and the Code. And incidentally, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Code. Oddly, the Code, when I first started as Commissioner, most of our investigations were under the Code, and then they sort of dwindled after 3 or 4 years, and now they're mostly under the Act. The members don't seem to be getting into an awful lot of trouble unless they're ministers or parliamentary secretaries. So the two sections that I consider absolutely the sort of pivotal ones as far as the rules go is 6.1, which basically says a public office holder can't make a decision in the exercise of his office if it would further a private interest. And that could be a private interest of his own, his or her own, I should say, but I won't say his or her all the time, his family or another person if it would be improper. So in other words, any time he's furthered a private interest using his office and it's found to be improper, then it could be an offense. And that is where there's quite a bit of discretion, of course, in the commissioner to decide what's improper. I started off with trying to develop some parameters around that. I said, certainly if it's prohibited under another act of parliament, it's improper, and I sort of went out from there. But it's the other thing about running an office like that, it's a sort of an inductive process. You go through and find different cases and gradually develop your precedents. And the other one is sort of a little bit of a diversion on that rule, that section 9, which says you can't advance a private interest by seeking to influence somebody else who's making the decision. So that would come if you're sort of trying to lobby a minister or something. Incidentally, the Lobbying Act is quite intimately related in some ways to the Conflict of Interest Act, but Conflict of Interest Act, of course, covers a much, much broader range of stakeholders, and so there's a distinction you should be aware of there. So under Section 6.1, which is the one where you can't make a decision in the exercise of your office if it would further a private interest, a good case on that one is Nigel Wright, Chief of Staff of the Prime Minister. He was alleged to have improperly, to have furthered Senator Duffy's private interest by giving him $90,000. And but not only did he give him $90,000, there was a quid pro quo for that gift. And it was that Senator Duffy pay it and admit that he had actually owed that money. The weird thing about this all, just as a matter of aside, is that it turns out, as I can make out, Senator Duffy didn't know much at all, actually. It went away, I think. And I don't know what happened to that $90,000. It never came back into the government or out of the government coffers. But in any event, it didn't matter to me. The decision I took on that was that he was operating as a chief of staff when he took out of his own pocket. He sort of argued that it was out of his own pocket, so it didn't count. Well, damn it. It was in his role as chief of staff to the prime minister that he paid that money. And as I say, there was a government-related request that was made as a quid pro quo to Senator Duffy. So I thought it was quite clearly a contravention. It was improperly furthering, though, because he wasn't a friend and he wasn't a relative, Senator Duffy. As a matter of fact, I don't think they were great friends. But it was simply improper. And then the extra kicker on that, of course, is that under the Parliament of Canada Act, Section 6.3, there's a prohibition against compensating a senator for doing something, and he gave up his quid pro quo. So that one was actually fairly easy. Interesting thing about some of these people that contravene the Act, They're generally speaking quite honorable people. Nigel Wright has a very high reputation for honesty and rigor and whatnot. But you know, what I've found is some people have blind spots, and they think they're good. Their motives are good. They're trying to do good. But the trouble is, when there's rules that apply to everybody, they have to apply to the big guys too. And so, I think. Anyway, that was a good one. Then there's another one. Minister Dianne Finley, she was the Human Resources and Skills Development Minister. There was a funding capacity in her department to fund people that were had special programs for disabilities. Now, all these things are sort of pie great things, you know. They're all wonderful things to be doing. So that's why sometimes it's difficult to see that when you're doing something in that domain, you can still be contravening the Conflict of Interest Act. So basically what happened in that situation was there was a whole series of different steps you had to go through with more and more stringent rules if you were an applicant to see whether your project fit within the parameters, and then only a few of the best ones were picked. Well, there was this guy called Rabbi Mendelsohn who actually got some ties with the Conservative Party. He went on a couple of the trips with them abroad and whatnot, and was great at lobbying various departmental entities, including the Prime Minister's office. He was promoting about 6 projects across Canada, and what happened was none of them made it. They made it in different degrees into the vetting. But one of them was in Toronto, the Markham Centre for Skills and Independence. And it lost out sort of midway along the line, but it was never high. It was always, at the last cut it was in, it was near the bottom. After you passed that cut, you had to go through an outside assessor as to see whether it was really a good project outside the government. And so it did not get that cut. So the people that were chosen were, you know, there was about 6 or 8 of them or something. It went to Minister Findlay, and she said, look, I want this project, the Markham Centre, to get that outside check. And so the suspicion was that she was some kind of in with Rabbi Mendelsohn. In fact, she wasn't. As it turned out, she didn't even know him. But there was also calls to the Prime Minister's office. In an investigation, I find there were calls from the Prime Minister's office over to her office and all sorts of interrelations there. Anyway, the ultimate decision was she gave the funding to this center. It wasn't even too well developed, the project. And because in the final analysis some years later, it failed. It had to close. It didn't be successful. So it goes to show the systems work. But she overrode it as the minister, and the final thing that came in, she chose the Markham Center to be one of the recipients. So I concluded, again, that was an improper use of her ministerial powers. And it was interesting because that one Harper took very badly. And Harper, incidentally, was that was bill number 2. It was the first bill introduced in the Harper regime when he came in, that Accountability Act that had the Conflict Act in it. He was always very assiduous in following the ethical issues, and he on several occasions put out notices to his ministers saying, are you sure you're doing this? Check and let the ethics commissioner know. And actually we issued a couple of contravention orders in light of that act that Prime Minister Harper took. But in any event, he never saw that this was improper because ministers have power. And when I went looking through it, the other little thing that I found was that there were Treasury Board guidelines that said that the ministers should not ignore or should take into account the public service input. And the input that they got was never positive. So anyway, that was another interesting case. Another fun one was the Watson Report. Much is done around the term friend in a couple of provisions of the Act, and it works well sometimes, but it does not always work well. The trouble is it's a very fuzzy concept, and you know, you can be a friend at all sorts of different levels. Anyway, that one, Watson was on the Toronto Port Authority, and he was on the board, and they were trying to decide whether to put a new fancy ferry over to the Toronto Island airport. See, I had these reporting public office holders who were GIC appointees, and there were all different levels of people. He took part in the vote, and the claim was he should have recused himself because he was a friend of Mr. I always forget his name anyway, the guy that runs Porter, Deluce, Robert Deluce, who was the president of Porter Air. And Watson used to go around all the time saying, I'm a great friend of Robert Deluce. He's just a great buddy of mine. Well, the fact of the matter is, when I sort of looked around, nobody else thought he was a friend of Robert Deluce, including Robert Deluce. So, but the funny thing was, if he had been a friend, I would have found he contravened. He should have recused. But the fact of the matter was, I found he wasn't a friend, which must have been very embarrassing to him. But I found he didn't contravene the act. the other little factor there was it really didn't matter to Porter whether there was a new ferry or not. And so it really wasn't, although at the time Porter was the only person going. Anyway, now I'm running late on time here. I could go through a few more. Preferential treatment, I'll just mention Section 7 is just the pits of a section. It's totally too narrow. It says you can't give preferential treatment to any person, which sounds very good, but then it adds, based on the identity of the person making the representations. So that's crazily narrow. So there are very few cases on 7, but I did have one where I actually found a contravention, and that was Mr. Parody. You'll remember Minister Jaffer, who left the government and wandered off. Anyway, he was trying to promote a solar panels project for federal buildings, and he went to Parody, who I guess was in the relevant department there, and wanted him to kind of get his office to start picking this up. And Parody directed his staff to organize a meeting with Jaffer. Well, in the final analysis, that contravened the act because he used his office to give somebody special treatment, and because, in fact, that was not the normal way you got into the office to get that sort of stuff backed. So he jumped the regular system, and I found that to be improper. That's probably as far as I've gone, because there was no rule per se that I based that on, except it was just darn right improper. But I did find that they weren't friends. 1 minute. Oh, gee. What'll I hit? Well, I'll have to hit Trudeau, I guess. I've got another one on Nigel, and I've got another one. I haven't even gotten to gifts. I'll get into gifts. Okay. So gifts, as I said, friends work okay on the contravention under 7 and 9, but they don't work so well under the gifts provisions because in my opinion, and I've come to this after dealing with the Trudeau case, a friend, that was the hardest thing in that decision. A friend is an excuse. You get out from under the rule. But the rule is if it can reasonably be seen to have been given to influence. Well, that's the best rule of all. There's some flexibility there, and sometimes in a friend situation you can reasonably be seen. In another kind of a friend situation, you can't reasonably be seen. So that was my recommendation that came out of the Trudeau report. But anyway, he basically, I mean, you all know the story. The Trudeau went to the island of the Aga Khan. Now, the Aga Khan, that was a very, very interesting, it was double the length of any of my other reports. It was a very interesting report to put together. I learned a lot about the Ismaili faith, and the difficulty of that one was that the Aga Khan was doing good stuff. I mean, he always had good projects. And the projects that the Aga Khan had were in line with Canadian diversity objectives and stuff. So it was hard to kick the Aga Khan. But Trudeau, and there was two stages when Trudeau's people went down to the Aga Khan's island. One was when he was a minister, one was when he was a member. I actually found that he didn't contravene as a member because the members had no power whatsoever to give grants to the Aga Khan's projects. But the fact of the matter was that the Aga Khan had business with the government, and I went through the whole thing about whether he was a friend, and I concluded, it is really quite a fun read, that report. I concluded that there was 30 years absence between when Trudeau sort of hung around as a kid with his father in the Aga Khan, and when the Aga Khan came back into his life, and the Aga Khan happened to come into his life when he became the leader of the Liberal Party. So I just concluded that was not really what I would call a friend, although Trudeau, I'm sure, feels, and he may well be on that kind of a relationship, but that was neither here nor there. So that's the grounds upon which I found there was no exception. It could reasonably seem to have been given to influence him. And, you know, the funny thing was that over the months when I was looking into that report, I had people around me in different circles that I saw. So what the heck are you investigating Trudeau for that for? You know, he deserves a holiday for his sake, you know. But the interesting thing was when the report came out, I don't see it. I didn't see any negative reaction to that at all. So I was very pleased. Do I have to stop?
Yeah,
I'll stop.
Why don't you stop and then we'll allow some questions.
Okay.
I think there may be some very interesting questions for you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay.
Okay. Well, as you can see from what Mary said, there, where the rubber hits the road can be a very complex place. So let's see if there's anyone who wants to start off the questioning. Well, Bob.
Well, I'm not going to start with an easy one. You ended with Trudeau and Trudeau as Prime Minister. Ralph's presentation towards the end pointed out that among the perhaps five factors, I'm not quite sure if I got it correct, but he ended with the point about leadership being the issue that over time proves to be the most important, that one needs to have ethical leadership, and if that's lacking, then the other things, you know, can help. The person from Justice mentioned before that it does help to have these other processes and so forth in place, but ultimately ethical leadership is important. And your time in that office was over the last decade, and as other people have said already this morning, it's been that was a tough decade in terms of ethical leadership at the top. So I just want to pose that as the issue, that we can't talk about the Tait report as something that talks about leadership up to and including the Clerk of the Privy Council and the Secretary of the Treasury Board, but not above that. Mm-hmm. It does go above that. Mm-hmm. And without you asking you to you know, pass on anecdotes about the last 10 years, what would you say about the future? How can a country, and one can talk about the United States now, one can talk about various regimes where even people who support the elected head for this or that or the other reason probably wouldn't want that person as the Girl Scout or Boy Scout leader. You know, that's not the tone at the top. That's not the ethical who are we? Again, Ralph's point about the Aristotelian question, what kind of people are we? That's not really what we want. So you've got a situation where there's a legally elected head who's not giving the ethical direction that one really wants. What can one do about it?
Well, you know, both of these leaders have a good ethical sense. I must say, though, it's very your political staff is very important, and I think the political staff probably fell down in some of these cases, actually, for the ministers, but because they should be able to rely on decent advice from the political staff. But, you know, what was I going to say? These leaders, particularly Harper, was terribly ethically in tune. It's just that and Nigel Wright had the same problem. Harper had the same issue over Finlay, and Trudeau had it in spades, where, you know, they felt they were doing good things, they meant well, and they just didn't think they were capable. They didn't pay enough attention to the minutiae of the rules. They felt they were doing good things by and large. That's why I don't think they should be hung if they could infringe the act. But it's just, I think that all these decisions are should be very instructive and helpful to make politicians understand that, that it is important. And I think making of a decision like some of those ones is important to the public to see that they're called on it. I mean, certainly the commissioner has to be, not to worry about offending the politicians. And, of course, as a matter of fact, that gets into the choice of commissioners. I do think that it would be better chosen from an independent panel than from the prime minister. There's still that little tiny link where the prime minister does the nominating, and there's rules in there that he's supposed to consult with all the other parties. But in fact, it appears to have been observed more in the breach than the duty. And I think it probably would be better, particularly since it's an entity of Parliament, the Conflict of Interest and Commissioner's Office, should probably be parliamentarians or somebody like that, or just eminent people, something that nominate the first group. So that it's a sort of roundabout answer to your question, but I mean, I think there are signs on the horizon that there are ways that that draw attention to the important that they make a good example themselves. I don't think he hasn't gone to the Aitkenes Islands since he stayed in Canada for his next couple and he's checking, I think, probably still very assiduously with the office, at least his staff are, as to whether vacations are okay.
Okay, thanks. Another question up here.
Thank you. My name is Maria, and I'm a newer public servant and a current student here in the Master's Program of Public Ethics. Learning from the anecdotes and trying to get the experience that you've learned throughout the years and through the evolution of these conflicts as well and problems that rose in and came to your desk at the time, I wanted to ask, parting as well from the answer that you just provided and the first panel in the Aristotelian question that was raised as well, is it a problem of the system or is it a problem of the individual? How did you see the transition of those conflicts that came to your desk? And looking into the future, what can the younger generations learn from that so that we don't make the same mistakes?
You know, I'll tell you an anecdote in answer to that question. I think things are getting better and better. I mean, attention is being paid to these issues, so I only see better behavior rather than worse behavior in the future. But I once had a letter come into my office addressed to me from a student in some school out west, like I think it was a public school even, not even high school. And the question was, do you think John A. McDonald breached the ethics rules or, you know, was unethical in some of the ways he behaved? And I thought this was kind of a cute letter, so I took some time and wrote a nice little letter back to this kid. And I said, yeah, times change, and at the time that he was prime minister, there weren't any rules that applied. But I said, probably I would have found that he contravened the ethics law had he been under it. A journalist got hold of this, and there was this huge headline out west that said, conflict interest commissioner says John A. McDonald contravened ethics rules. But and it's funny, I mean, things do move in the opposite direction. I think of one very early case, the Thibault case. This is way back when Mulroney was being investigated, sort of, and the cabinet. There was a committee of Parliament that was meeting to decide whether he should, what they should do about the Mulroney problems. And Thibault was on the committee. Well, the allegation that came to me and afterwards was Thibault should have recused himself from sitting on that committee and voting on it because Thibault was being sued by Mulroney for libel. And so I found against Thibault. I said, yes, he should have recused himself from the committee. Well, the next thing I know, I tabled this thing in the House, at least the Speaker tables it in the House, and the House never, every single report that I've tabled in the past has never had any comment. Just after 30 days, it's deemed accepted, and that's the end of it. But this one, the House actually made a motion that I review this, they didn't like my decision. But what they did in the meantime was they changed the code. They amended it, and they had a libel exception. So if you're being sued for libel, the rule doesn't apply, and you can go and sit in committees. I mean, it probably never come up again. But I sort of laughed. So they sent it back to me, and they said, okay, lady, look at it again. And so I looked at it again, and I said, yeah, he was still guilty under the old act, but under the new act, he wouldn't have been. You know. But anyway, things change. Things move along in all directions. But I think it's always moving forward.
Thank you very much. But I'm an optimist. Thank you.
That's good.
Yeah.
Oh, final question.
I'd like to know if you ever, influenced to in your job, not investigating on one thing, if you had pressures somehow to report that way or to perhaps not talk about something, and if you had been pressured somehow, I won't ask you whom, but would you have had tools to push back or to, you know, to defend your role?
Very rarely. It's interesting that when I was investigating people, they were always extremely cooperative. They were very nice to me. they wanted it to come out okay. But I did, in one case, come under abuse when I was the person had a lawyer. I won't name them, I guess. And the lawyer and that person threatened me with taking me to the Law Society because I wasn't practicing, I wasn't following due process or something. Well, I damn well was following due process and everything was fine, but they said, we object strenuously to this whole thing, we're not guilty and we're taking you. And I just basically ignored them, although in the report I did make an oblique allusion to that. But no, I that's the other thing that's nice. I mean, the office has been respected and the investigations have been done very, very well, and that was the only instance I had where I was actually basically attacked. And they were yelling at me during the investigation. The stupid thing was, it was all being recorded. I mean, when this particular thing happened, it was happening long distance, and we were doing it on a screen, and it was all there on tape. And if they'd ever gone to the Law Society, it would have been horrible for them. And not only that, I mean, I worked with the Justice Department, actually. The Justice, actually, for some reason, which I can't really articulate, when somebody comes after the office, Justice is the lawyer that looks after it. It's not an outside lawyer, and even though we're not part of the government. And the Justice, in order to get a hold of all the documents, we weren't allowed to divulge them, but they could get a court order and get it divulged, and we actually encouraged them to get a court order to get it divulged, because we were actually, I remember it was a judicial review that was taken. I don't know. Anyway, yes, it was a judicial review, I think. And so that we divulged everything we could possibly find. We knew this guy was ruined if it ever came out. So he wisely, at some point, desisted from the judicial review.
Interesting. Mary, I'm going to take the privilege of asking you one final question, because we have a number of people here in the room who are in somewhat analogous roles to your own, in the sense that they are at the head of the ethics regimes in their departments or agencies, and I wondered if you had any comment on what it feels like to exercise the leadership role in an area such as ethics, because they would, I think, enjoy hearing any thoughts that you might have about exercising leadership in this area and how important it is.
Well, it's certainly important. You know, I think I must have a high threshold of worry or something, because I really never, I just did the thing. And the thing is, if you know you're doing the right thing, you do it, you know. And so I was never troubled. I certainly got negative remarks made about me from time to time, but I just thought, well, they just don't know any better. So all I can say is it was okay.
It was okay. Well, take heart, all of you who are in those roles. That's okay. Well, thank you very, very much, Mary. Appreciate it.
I'd like to invite Scott Serson down to give a short tribute to John Tate. Scott had a long public service career, including head of the Public Service Commission and deputy minister at Indian and Northern Affairs. And in the early 2000s, Scott Serson and Janet Cochran were asked to do a special extra job off the edge of their desks to be the public service champions for values and ethics, and therefore we thought that he'd be an appropriate person to talk a little bit about the influence of John Tate, what he meant, and what it meant also a bit to him to try and carry on the direction and energy that he felt John was putting into this area. Thank you very much, Scott.
Thanks, Bob. I feel totally inadequate to the task here. And I want to make sure that everybody, I understand everybody's been given a copy of this tribute that Ralph Heinzman wrote when John passed, and he did an excellent job, so I think people are looking for a tribute to John. That's the full text. What I wanted to do this morning, just very briefly, is highlight one period of my relationship with John, and what I think it says about the man, and then turn briefly to a strong foundation and highlight one of the many passages that was and still is very important to me. I will warn you, in case any of you are embarrassed by emotion, that I may get emotional. I often do when I'm talking about somebody who is very important to me, especially as I age. So one thing John and I shared is an early introduction to the cause of justice for the First Peoples of this land and a strong ongoing commitment to that cause. We got the opportunity to work together on a number of occasions, but most intensively on related law and policy in 1990. John was Deputy Minister of Justice, and I was an Assistant Secretary at the Federal-Provincial Relations Office, but responsible for constitutional affairs. As Ralph put it, we were plunged into, John and I together with others, Mary, plunged into the aftermath of the failure of the Meech Lake Accord and began working on what eventually would emerge as the Charlottetown Accord. Now, where Indigenous peoples were left out of the Meech Lake process, Constitutional Affairs Minister Joe Clark made sure that they were full participants in the Charlottetown process. And so John and I and others ended up working on one of the key Indigenous policy issues, and that is their inherent right to self-government. Now, as I said, I was an assistant secretary at the time, so there were a few public service classification levels between John and I. But for John, that was not a barrier to dealing directly with me. As Ralph has noted, and I think Mary has underlined, John was a tough and exacting leader. I, having been part of the failed Aboriginal constitutional process between 95 and or 1985 and 1987, was quite committed to seeing the inherent right recognized in our Constitution. And I admit that that was as much an issue of the mind as of the heart. So we were then, John and I, in a number of meetings, some with colleagues, quite a few bilaterals, as I recall, where we discussed and often debated quite vehemently the recognition of the inherent right. In the end, the Charlottetown Accord was approved by First Ministers with an amendment recognizing the inherent right. And I believe John was as pleased as I was about that. And he was as disappointed as I was that the accord failed in the subsequent referendum. But subsequent to that, you know, you don't do a kind of a interpersonal debriefing. So I came away from that process worried about whether I'd pushed John too hard, whether I'd lost his respect. So I fast forward now to late 1998 or early 1999. I think I have those times correct. And I got a call from John's office to meet with him. So you can imagine my relief, amazement, what evolved into pride when, having explained to me that he was going to be taking some time off for health reasons, John asked me, along with Janice Cochran, to take on the next stage of his work on values and ethics and lead the honest dialogue that his report called for. So the Tate report talks about encountering the good. I note it doesn't say the perfect. As Mary has noted, John had a temper, but I think those of us who worked with him recognize that for the most part, that temper was released because he cared so profoundly about some of the issues that he was working on. I hope my little story illustrates what others have said over the years about John. Those of us that were fortunate enough to work with John Tate encountered a flesh and blood example of values-based ethical leadership. We encountered the good. When it came to people, John was more interested in character than classification. He was not threatened by different views passionately held. He was prepared to deal with ideas on their merits. He had a huge intellect and, to my mind, a spirit to match. Now, in the foreword to A Strong Foundation, and for the young public servants in the audience, I lift it up, I show it to you. It is online, it is still worth reading, it stands the test of time. In the foreword to A Strong Foundation, Jocelyn Burgon wrote, "If you seek John Tate's monument, read on." And there are many parts of John's monument that are important to me. As you can see, I don't dog ear, I put in little tabs where in important passages. But I do have a favorite, and Ralph underlined, a lot of A Strong Foundation is about leadership. And my favorite passage is about a leadership philosophy that I yearn for as an officer, that I saw reflected in John's work, and that I tried to instill wherever I worked. And this is that passage, quote, "Wherever we find ourselves in the public service and at whatever levels, we enjoy the deep privilege of public service, the opportunity to serve and help our country. And the obligations of leadership and initiative that go with them. We do not have to and should not wait for signals from others before undertaking the great tasks of public service leadership. Exercising imagination, creativity, and vigilance for the public good and caring for the people entrusted to our charge." End quote. So, that's the leadership philosophy that I think John lived by, and I think it continues to be important to all public servants. So I'm going to stop there, Bob. I don't know how we're doing for time. If we're okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. I think that's a lovely, very thoughtful note on which to conclude our morning.